This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, the topic is the thinking and recent decisions of the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. I have the great pleasure of having 2 incredible authorities on constitutional law. Lawrence Tribe, who is a constitutional law professor at Harvard Law School. He's the author of the new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. My other guest is Myron Moskowitz, who I think is quite familiar to all of you, as he's been a guest on my program, I don't know, for at least 20 years or so. He is now an appellate litigator, appellate consultant, professor of law emeritus from Golden Gate University School of Law. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Gentlemen, I welcome you to the program.
Thank you, Chuck.
You can hear me okay, Larry?
I certainly can.
Good, good. Your book, Uncertain Justice, why did you entitle it that?
Well, because too many people have too many certitudes about the court, and they're all wrong. I mean, the people who think that the court is just leaning rightward all the time miss the boat. The court who think, you know, all the people who think it's a fight between conservatives and liberals, between activists and non-activists, it's understandable because that's the way the press talks about it. But I'm convinced that in order to get a handle on this enormously important institution that affects everybody's lives, their sex lives, whether they can own a gun, whether they will encounter guns in a shopping center, what their rights to vote are all about, whether the government can sort of put pressure on them to either join in a prayer or slink out of a town meeting. Those are all profoundly important, and people just don't understand where the court is coming from if they insist on either bumper sticker slogans or on legalese. And in fact, there are lots of uncertainties about where the court is going to go. It's inherent in the process, but we certainly don't have to confuse ourselves by stereotyping and replacing the rich texture of what it's all about with cardboard cutouts.
Who's your audience? Who do you see as your audience for Uncertain Justice?
You know, any intelligent person who has a basic education and who cares about the way the law affects his or her life. I mean, that means readers of the San Francisco Chronicle or the LA Times or the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune. It means people who listen to your program. It means the high school music teacher of one of my research assistants who was fascinated when he described as a book tour and who has found it very educational and fun. So the audience is really anybody who is listening right now, I would say.
This is a very good time for us to get together because obviously in the last, about 10 days or so, there have been some very significant decisions that the U.S. Supreme Court has come down with. We have Riley versus California, which is the cell phone and the search warrant case. We have Hobby Lobby. Where would you like to start on this, Larry? What case?
Well, I think the case that people will remember 20 years from now, 30 years from now, and that will mark the entry of the Supreme Court into the digital age, and the case that affects everybody, whether or not you're ever stopped or arrested by the police, even though it technically applies only in that context, is the cell phone case, Riley against California, and it had a companion case from the which there was a federal prosecution. I think that's really dynamite.
Okay, I'd like you both to talk about this a bit. This is a situation where prior to this decision, and correct me if I'm wrong, prior to this decision, if someone was arrested for something, some kind of criminal violation, and the police felt that and found a cell phone on this person, and usually this comes in the context of narcotics trafficking, the police would take a look right away without any kind of search warrant with respect to the contents of the cell phone.
Well, it starts before that, Chuck.
Okay, go ahead.
There was a case 20 years ago or so at Robinson versus California where they arrest a man and the police go through his pockets and they do a thorough search and they find a crumpled up cigarette pack. They look inside and they find some narcotics. And the Supreme Court said the search was okay, that if you arrest somebody, there's a danger they may have a weapon on them and there's a danger they may try to destroy evidence on them. So the police are entitled to a complete search. So if they find a wallet, they can open the wallet. And that was the holding of the case. And they said the police need a bright line, something easy to follow. They don't need to get a search warrant. They don't need a special reason. And then this is long before cell phones were invented.
Well, I mean,
now cell phones come along, and the prosecution says, well, it's like a wallet. In a wallet, you might store an address book or private information, and it's just a big wallet. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's totally different. This is your whole life on your cell phone. It's not just a telephone. It's got your addresses. It's got your apps that show that you go to the doctor for certain treatments. It's got everything about you. And if the police find a cell phone, they're going to have to go to a magistrate and get a search warrant and show probable cause to believe there's evidence in that cell phone. And they can't just automatically search it unless they have some special unusual reason, like the guy's about to delete everything.
Larry, what was the justice's situation on this? What was the vote on this one?
Well, Riley, the vote was 9-0.
Yeah,
although there was a little technical glitch that led Alito to write a separate thing, but it was done by my former student. I always think of him that way, even though he's got much more important credentials than that. John Roberts, the Chief Justice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He wrote for a unanimous court. And to go back to something that Myron was saying, you know, the government, and that includes the Obama administration, which was defending what the prior law looked like in most of the country, the Obama administration and the Attorney General of California took the, I think, outrageous position that there really is no difference between taking a wallet or a letter out of somebody's pocket and going through a cell phone. And Roberts' opinion said that's like saying that a ride on horseback is no different from a flight to the moon.
That was a good phrase.
Roberts generally has a very nice, common sense, somewhat humorous way of putting things. And in this case, that really captured the essence. He actually said the term cell phone is misleading shorthand. That a lot of these devices are basically mini computers that just happen to have the capacity to be used as a phone. You could call them cameras, Rolodexes, calendars, tape recorders, libraries, diaries, albums, newspapers, it's everything. Now, that didn't make it an easy case. The point is that the justices in recent cases had been sort of finding their way slowly through the dark of new technology. There was a case about texting. And that's texting with a T, not sexting with an S. A case about texting while you're on the job. And Justice Kennedy in that case said, you know, this is a new technology. We're not sure how to think about it. This is a case where the court kind of boldly grabbed the new technology. It's an opinion that shows marvelous mastery of remote wiping, encryption, Faraday bags. At one point in his opinion, Chief Justice Roberts says that in this brave new world, the phrase, there's an app for that, has entered our lexicon for everything from sharing prayer requests to improving your sex life. And the court recognized that in this brave new world, it has a role to play, even though the framers obviously didn't give any specific solution to the problem. Roberts politely noted in his opinion the absence of what he called precise guidance from the founding era. He's sort of a master of understatement, and what's amazing is that justices like Scalia and Thomas, who often make a big point of how the understanding of the Constitution at the time it was written should be our guide, they didn't utter a peep about how this is a departure from that way of looking at the Constitution. And I think that shows that the court has entered a new era in more ways than one.
Larry's right about that. There was another case last year that dealt with GPS tracking. The police in Washington, D.C., stick a GPS tracker on the underside of this guy's car, thinking he's a drug dealer, and they want to know where he's going. Well, was that a search under the Fourth Amendment? Prior opinions of the court would indicate no, because it depended on whether you have an expectation of privacy. Well, the undercarriage of your car is not private. You know, it's just a place that holds up the bottom of the car. And what the GPS recorder communicates is also not private. It's where you go out on public streets. So traditional reasoning would say there's no search here and the police don't need a warrant or anything. And yet the majority of the court said, yes, there is a search here. Scalia wrote the opinion.
All nine justices said it, but they had two different ways of getting
there. Yeah, that's right. But that was, I think, their first recent venture into new technology. They weren't quite as forthright as they were in Riley. But as Larry said, they're trying to cope with these new devices and recognize it. I think there's a line in Riley where Roberts says, we don't know what's going to happen next. And we got to have a rule that encompasses these new devices after our opinion is issued, because it's just moving so fast.
I want to throw something out to both of you, if I may. There's also been a lot of talk about the most recent Hobby Lobby case that came down. I think it was on the 30th of this month, or of last month, pardon me, involving contraceptives, and in particular the morning after pill and IUDs. The question I have for both of you, and this is where the closely held corporation, which had 13,000 employees, it was run by a family, they believed that any of their employees, through their insurance provisions, might be able to get the morning after pill or the IUD. They felt that those should not be covered by their insurance, and they so informed their insurance carrier.
For religious reasons.
Religious reasons. Yeah. I mean, they were concerned that what they were dealing with or being confronted with is that both the morning after pill and the IUDs were really abortificants, abortion.
Chuck, let me just correct you a little. It's true that they believed that, but the court's decision is vastly broader. The court said, you know, it doesn't, even if their objection was contraception itself is evil, even if it's not like abortion. Simplest contraceptive, you know, regardless of how it works, because their religion teaches not only that they should not use contraceptives, but that they shouldn't in any way be involved in anybody else's use of them, like their own employees who may have a different religious view, or their students at a religiously affiliated college, then it's a substantial burden on their religion to have anything to do with it. And in fact, in Wheaton College and in other places now after Hobby Lobby, the position that they've taken is we don't limit our objection to cases where we have to pay for it or where we have to make sure that our insurer pays for it. We don't even believe that we can be forced to tell the government that we've got an objection. You have to sort of read our minds. As Justice Ginsburg pointed out in her dissent, the decision of startling breadth to say that a religious employer, including a closely held corporation, and the court never explained why the decision wouldn't logically extend to all corporations, there's no line between them drawn in the Constitution or in Congress's legislation to protect religious freedom. She called it, Justice Ginsburg in her dissent, called it a decision of startling breadth, and I'm afraid it is. And I think the court really took a very dangerous step toward making, sort of empowering people to use their religion as an excuse to impose burdens on third parties.
Let me throw...
How would that apply to racial discrimination or discrimination against women.
Well, the court tries to say that we're not talking about racial discrimination because in that case there is no other alternative. Here, the point the court made was that you could protect the female employee's right to get contraceptive coverage by having the insurer pay without any burden on the employer, or by having the government reimburse the insurer, and that there is no alternative in the discrimination case. But right now, people who and companies that believe that the gay and lesbian groups among us are pursuing a sinful life are asking to be exempt from anti-discrimination provisions, and the current intention of the Obama administration to announce that federal contractors must stop discriminating based on sexual orientation is one that they're trying to challenge on the theory of the Hobby Lobby case, and we haven't heard the last of that yet. We're moving in a direction where church and state are being terribly blurred.
Let me throw a question to both of you on this, with regard to the decision in Hobby Lobby, which held that the owners of this business were right in not agreeing that their insurance carriers should provide contraceptives to their employees. The attorney for the owners of the business said that they only objected to four of the contraceptives, not another 16. But my question to you both is this. If their employees, who may have had, obviously, may have been following a religion or maybe not any religion whatsoever that had anything to do with the religion practiced by their employer, if, for example, using this Hobby Lobby decision, if these employees, women employees, were using the morning after pill or had an IUD, do you think an extension of this decision would be, if an employer found out about this, that he would either not hire someone like that or fire someone like that? Larry, what do you think?
I'm afraid that that is a possible extension. And happily, this decision was 5-4.
Yeah.
And because it was written by Justice Alito, not the Chief Justice, it was written in a way that was designed to make sure that all five hung together, but they hang together by a thread. And I'm hoping that the thread can be cut before it becomes a rope that basically hangs the country in really an abandonment of our founding principle that to avoid religious divisiveness and to protect individual conscience, people should not be able to impose their religion on others. And, you know, in another case this term that really bothered me a great deal, and I talk about in the book Uncertain Justice, I sort of talk about how that's coming down the road, and now it's, of course, the rubber has hit the road. In a case called Town of Greece, the Supreme Court held, again by a vote of 5-4, that it's perfectly okay for town meetings to begin with a sectarian prayer. I mean, it was almost all of the prayers in this little town were Christian prayers, although they said that they'd be willing to, you know, they'd be willing to let other religions in and so forth. But Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, said that if you're not forced to pray, even though this is the town meeting where you go to get a variance or to get other, to participate in other ways in local government, you're not forced to pray. You can just slink out. He didn't put it that way, but I'm afraid that's what it comes down to.
It was worse than that. Here's what happened. The majority describes this prayer as a prayer for the benefit of the legislators, to give them inspiration from God.
No, that's wrong. These were not legislators. This is a town meeting. They went way beyond legislation.
Well, that's right. But that's the way they described it, because they compared it to an older case involving the Nebraska legislature, which led off with a prayer. And the court said that's okay, because Congress does it. And they tried to say this is pretty much the same thing. But Justice Kagan, in her dissent, said, she looked at the record carefully, and she said, here's what actually happens. This Christian minister gets up at the council meeting. His back is to the councilman, so he's not talking to them. He's talking directly to the people who come to the citizens, who come there to get some help. They want some legislation passed, or maybe they're in a fight with their neighbor about a zoning variance. And the minister says, let us pray. And behind him are the council members crossing themselves. And somebody who's not Christian, who's in the audience, who wants something from the council, has to think, if I don't get up and pray with them, I'm going to lose my case.
Maybe they're going to hold it against me. Yeah.
Especially, and the court didn't mention this, but I've been involved in local government. Quite often, it's against somebody else, some other citizen. And if that other citizen gets up and prays, and you don't, what do you think is going to happen?
Good friend of the local.
And the majority says, this is okay. This does not violate the Establishment Clause.
Let me interrupt for just a moment so everyone knows who's here. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about recent decisions of the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. I wish we had 3 hours to do this. We don't. My guests are Myron Moskovitz, appellate litigator, appellate consultant, professor of law, emeritus, Golden Gate University School of Law, Lawrence Tribe, constitutional law professor at Harvard Law School, author of the new book, which I highly recommend to you. It's a wonderful read, Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution, which has come out just very, very recently. So for those of you who are interested in the law, and in particular constitutional law, I highly suggest you take a look at it. What I thought was so beautiful about, and by the way, for those of you who are listening to us live, we'll take some calls in just a few minutes. What I thought was such an incredible dissent in the Town of Greece case was Justice Kagan's dissent, where she really shows that with our Congress, with our state legislators, when they are starting a meeting in Congress or in the state legislators at the beginning of the meeting with some kind of prayer, that is for the benefit of the members of Congress and for the members of the legislature and not for the public. Right. And she made a great distinction between that and the situation of a town council meeting such as in Town of Greece. And I thought her decision was just outstanding.
Right. Yeah. So this is Larry speaking. I felt like a proud father. I mean, Elena Kagan was a research assistant of mine, as was the president, and boy, did she knock it out of the park. I mean, it was a brilliant dissent. Her best opinion, I think, since she joined the court.
Yeah, I agree. It was really
brilliant,
good.
Partly because it came from both the heart and from an understanding of American history and from an understanding of the text. It basically said, you know, what it means to be Americans, what it means to be in this country is to have escaped a world in which you are under this indirect pressure to either pray with the majority or single yourself out and kind of put yourself in the position of being an outsider. It was an eloquent dissent, but in my view, it did not go far enough, because although it is a lot worse when the person delivering the prayer, they call him the prayer giver, faces the audience and basically puts you on the spot. Are you going to join in this prayer, or are you going to single yourself out and maybe be disadvantaged? Even though that's a lot worse than this ritualistic beginning of legislative sessions for the benefit of the lawmakers of Congress and so on, for a prayer giver to face the lawmakers, that should have been held unconstitutional, too. The court, I think, took a wrong turn back in 1983 when it said that was okay because, you know, we've done it from the start. It hasn't ended us in a theocracy. But I think even when you put a halo around the legislature, you take a dangerous step toward kind of blessing, you know, making it seem as though if you're out of step with the lawmakers of your society, you're out of step with God. And unfortunately, not one justice in this case suggested that old decision should be reconsidered. They were, I think, in part inspired by the fact that the Obama administration filed a brief saying that old decision was right, but that this is a different thing. And in fact, they defended even this.
You know, I found it interesting that the five justices in the majority in the Town of Greece case were all Christian. They're all Catholic. And the dissenters, all three Jews on the court dissented, plus Sotomayor, who happens to be Catholic.
When you say, I really find that offensive, Myron. I'm sorry. She doesn't just happen to be Catholic. This was not a split between Catholics and Jews. As it happens, You know, you can make a point about the disparate.
No, I think it's relevant. I don't think it's offensive. I'm Jewish, and I grew up in a similar situation where I
don't think.
Wait a minute. Well, let me say my piece on this. I remember when I was in high school, and we had a Spanish teacher who insisted on singing very religious songs and teaching us very Christian aspects in Spanish language. And I was the only Jewish kid in class, and I had to participate. And I'm not very religious myself, but I really felt this pressure from government that is exactly what Kagan is describing.
I know, and, but Myron, I'm Jewish too, and I also went through that experience. But one of the things that I love about this country is that we have gotten away from carving ourselves up by religion. And what you are doing, not nearly as bad as what the majority in town of Greece did, just makes another contribution toward religious divisiveness.
No, what I'm saying, look, Scalia was so insensitive in that case. He says, well, of course the minister looks at everybody and says, let us pray. That's what ministers do. Well, they do it in church. They don't do it in government.
Wait,
it was a totally different perspective.
I was told we were supposed to interrupt each other.
Go ahead. Your turn, Larry.
I'm not defending anything about the majority opinion in Town of Greece. Through most of my book, I see a lot of good things, even about opinions I disagree with. This is an opinion that is offensive in all of those ways. All I'm saying is that we mess up the message a little bit if we emphasize that five on the majority were Christians and, in fact, Catholics, and that only one in the dissent was a Catholic. I mean, big deal. They would have, the majority would have come out the same way, regardless of religion. And I think they're misguided not because of the religion that they belong to. They're misguided because they're not sufficiently sensitive to how people who don't belong to that religion can be made to feel.
All I'm saying is they take it for granted that we're a Christian country and Christian prayers offered at every council meeting is perfectly fine with them. The Jewish justices do not take that for granted.
Let me just say, gentlemen, we are coming to the end of the statewide version of the program. And for those of you who are listening to this program live, whether it's in the Bay Area or on the Internet at www.kalw.org, we will continue for an additional half hour, giving you a chance to call in and ask some questions. So be patient with us, and we will be back with you in just a minute. All right. It is 7:27 and about a half at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is your Legal Rights, everybody. And this is your opportunity, if you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, chat with my guests. The number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. Whether you are listening in the Bay Area or you're listening anywhere in the country, because we are on the Internet, and most of the audience on the Internet is in California, but occasionally we do get some people calling in from other states. My guests are very, very significant, let's say, authorities on constitutional law. Lawrence Tribe is a constitutional law professor at Harvard Law School. How many years there, Larry?
I hate to admit it, but I've been teaching there for 45 years.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Terrific. Fantastic. He's also the author of a new book, which I think you'll find if you are interested in the law, and in particular constitutional law, I think you'll find it a fascinating read, Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court, and the Constitution. My other guest is Myron Moskovitz, who was a professor of law at Golden Gate University School of Law for 40 years. He recently retired. He's now professor of law emeritus. He's an appellate litigator, appellate consultant, and it's my pleasure to have both of them here. So I want to encourage all of you who may have some questions, maybe some comments, maybe some confusion about the Supreme Court or their decisions, or maybe you just don't like what's been going on. I urge you to call in. Don't wait until the last minute. 1-415-841 4134. And for those of you who join us for Call a Lawyer Night, we will do that in 2 weeks on July 23rd. You'll have a chance to talk with attorneys off the air while I'm doing the on-air program. You might want to jot down the number 1-800-525-9917. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours, 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced for you, set up a half an hour consultation, and pretty much throughout the state of California for a half an hour, it'll range from $25 to $35. It's a great way to get some very basic information. So please join us with your questions, your comments, and we're going to start with someone in just a moment as soon as Martin puts something on the screen here. What I'd like to throw out to you, though, Larry, is this. In your book, in your reference to Maryland versus King, which was the DNA case where the court determined that it was not in violation of the Constitution, it was not an unreasonable search, if the authorities got a cotton swab from the mouth of someone who had been arrested to collect DNA, that was not a violation of the Constitution. You write in your book that is a landmark decision. Justice Alito, in oral argument, said that was the most important criminal procedure case in the last several decades. What comments do you have on that?
Well, I tend to agree with Justice Alito about its importance, though I am troubled by the way the court came out. Even though Justice Scalia, whom everybody tends to caricature as always conservative, was the leading dissenter in the case, the majority, I think, turned the clock back by recognizing that even though the real purpose of a search like this is not to identify the suspect, that's what happens when you take a fingerprint, even though the court compared it to fingerprints, the real purpose is to build up the database universally, that this can be regarded as not a problem under the Fourth Amendment. And I think that it's dangerous. It's a movement in the direction of Big Brother, particularly because among those who are arrested, a very disproportionate number are minorities. If we all had to contribute our DNA to a database, and if there was some protection for anonymity, that might be a different thing. It would be more sweeping, but it wouldn't be a way of effectively invading the genetic privacy of the minorities among us. I think it's a scary decision. And it proves the wisdom of an admonition that the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, which of course includes California, Judge Alex Kaczynski, said when he said, new technologies test the judicial conscience. And I'm afraid the judicial conscience didn't perform as well as I would have liked in Maryland v. King.
And you've also written in your book, quote, King will change the landscape of American privacy, end quotes. What do you say to that?
Well,
what do you think is going to happen?
Having written it, I believe it. I'm afraid that the way in which the court approached DNA in that case was much less sensitive than the way in which it approached cell phones, unanimously holding that they couldn't be searched simply because someone who was arrested was carrying them. I hope that the cell phone decision, which came down at the end of this term unanimously, suggests that the court will not go further in the direction of invading privacy than it went in Maryland v. King. That was a low watermark and is not the beginning of a flood.
Are you concerned with Maryland versus King that, for example, even if we are not arrested for some kind of potential criminal violation, that we could, we the people, could have cotton swabs done of our mouths for DNA?
Yeah, I think it. Because this decision can't, in principle, be limited to people who are arrested. I think the underlying value of this huge store of information applies in spades when it is a universal database. And I'm quite worried that this could be the beginning of something much more terrifying, and I do think it's good, again, that it was 5-4, mm-hmm. and that the court has since that time taken a closer look at a different area of new technology.
Well, I hope you're right. Frankly, I don't think any of us want to have Big Brother come about.
So. I think it's a much harder case than Riley with involving the cell phones, because the intrusion on privacy with a cotton swab is far less than, you know, the data revealed by your cell phone. And the benefit pointed out by the majority was it results in matches sometimes that catch serious criminals. So
right. If you read the book, you'll see that I'm definitely aware of the many sides of a case like Maryland v. King. I don't say that there wasn't much to be said on the other side. There was plenty to be said on the other side. But even though your DNA does not contain a picture of your whole life, thank goodness we're not totally determined at birth in the way the cell phone might. Nonetheless, creating this huge, as Justice Scalia put it, genetic panopticon, enabling the government to find out all kinds of things about your relatives and all sorts of things about, you know, how likely, what proclivities do you have, it has a slightly scary stench of eugenics about it.
Let's take some questions. Jerry, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes.
You're on the air, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in a custody battle and for my kid, and I seem to not have any constitutional rights to see him. Are there anything, any rules that say I can get to see my kid?
Yeah, there are plenty of decisions by Justice Ginsburg in particular in a famous case a few years ago about how parents have important rights and they can't be deprived permanently of custody without an extraordinary showing. Both the genetic mother, the genetic father, the sociological mom and dad, the people who raise the kids, have important rights, but there are circumstances in which those rights can be cut off. You know, without knowing more about your situation, it would be hard for me to say much more.
Jerry, do you have a lawyer?
I certainly do.
Okay, and what county are you in?
Alameda.
And is your lawyer trying to do something to give you some kind of at least visitation?
Well, it's 1 hour a week.
That I see. You have some kind of a special situation for 1 hour a week. Is that right?
Yeah, 1 hour paid visitation.
I see.
$50 an hour.
I see. I got you.
And I was the primary parent for most of his life.
Yeah. Well, I feel for you, Jerry. It must be a horrible situation.
They won't allow my son to speak because he definitely wants to be with me.
You know, Jerry, the only other suggestion I might have for you, if you feel that you are being deprived of your rights, maybe you need to seek the advice of another attorney. I'm a great believer in people going to specialists. There's a certified specialist in family law. You might want to look into this to see if you can just have an initial consultation. Sometimes these certified specialists will do an initial consultation with no charge. It's just hard to say. Let me give you the statewide number for the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. It might be to your benefit to get some additional information. It's 415-538-2100, 415-538-2100. Also, I invite you to join us for our Call a Lawyer Night in 2 weeks, where we do have a family law specialist in the conference room who you can talk with off the air, obviously not indefinitely, but for a few minutes. And that number for Call a Lawyer Night, which will be on July 23rd, is 1-800-525-9917. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Take care, Jerry. Bye-bye. Let's see, who do we have now? I guess, all right, let me give you the number again. You're all very, very quiet tonight. I mean, here's an opportunity to talk with two really outstanding authorities on constitutional law. And frankly, it's a great privilege to have them with us. So the number is 1-415-841-4134. And Martin, who's next up? Okay, it is Pat. Pat, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, good evening. This
Hi.
Is Pat.
Yeah.
I have a question for both of your guests. Are you concerned that after the Hobby Lobby decision, people with all manner of, shall we say, unorthodox religious views will be coming forward and basically saying what that fellow in Nevada said, I don't recognize the government, I don't recognize any of these laws, my beliefs conflict with these particular laws, and I am not bound by them?
Well, that's very
interesting. I would be concerned if I thought the Supreme Court would go so far as to say that every man, every woman can be their own religion. But it's not going to go there. My concern is in a different direction. It's that people whose beliefs may not coincide with that of their employer or that of the college that they go to or the college that they work for or the hospital they work for, that they are going to be injured because they are unorthodox, because they don't have the majority's views.
So their rights will be restricted?
Well, their rights, I'm afraid that their rights will be subordinated to those of others. I mean, the court tried to limit the reach of its decision. There was a lot of stuff in there about how, you know, we're not talking about people who object to all medical care. We're not saying that your employer can refuse to comply with the law that requires that the employer provide health insurance for employees because the employer happens to be a Christian Scientist and doesn't believe in medical care. They claim that all those things would be different, but it's hard to say why. I mean, once the court takes the step it did in Hobby Lobby, I think you're a little bit right to be concerned about how far it'll go. I don't think it's going to go to the point of somebody saying, I don't believe in the government, I don't have to pay taxes, I don't have to obey the speed laws, my religion says I got to go 90 miles an hour. I think common sense is going to stop it from doing
yes.
that.
Well, to a point, see, both of these cases we've talked about, the Town of Greece case and the Hobby Lobby case, they both involved conventional Christianity, which is generally accepted by the majority of the court, and the beliefs of those people were highly respected. But if somebody has a more unusual religion, which has more unusual beliefs, and they want to exercise those beliefs in a healthcare situation or something else, the court's not going to be able to say they can't do it. Now, it can't be something like just I don't like government. It's got to be a genuine religious belief. But if it is, and it doesn't cause immediate harm, like my religion says I have to kill people, I think the court's going to have to respect that, too, no matter how strange most people think the religion is.
So
you know, one thing that everybody should know is that this case does not apply to state government. I mean, the Supreme Court has said that when the state government imposes a ban, let's say, on taking heroin or on taking some hallucinogen, then a group of people whose religion teaches that substance is a sacrament or that it violates their religion not to be able to take it, they're not entitled to any exemption. When Congress tried to change that by statute in a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the Supreme Court struck that down as applied to the states. So all we have left is this other bizarre rule that says the federal government must bend its laws unless there's some compelling reason not to when you have a genuine religious objection, but not the state and not the city and not the county.
So are
you seeing any impact on the slow but sure legalization of marijuana?
I don't think so. The court has already said, sort of rejected the opportunity to hold that people have a religious right to use marijuana, and the court in another case said that in states like California, where medical use of marijuana, and now, of course, it's become a lot more common in other states, where medical use of marijuana is carefully licensed and regulated, that the federal government still has paramount power, if they want to enforce it, to make it a crime to use marijuana, and in fact, to grow it, use it, not only sell or buy it. And although the Obama administration has not enforced that, interestingly enough, the people who are threatening to sue the president for not enforcing the laws are going to have to explain why they're not prosecuting people in California and other states, why they're not going after the president for not coming down hard on people who are making medical use of marijuana, but not in a way that's related to Hobby Lobby.
Pat, we're going to move on. Thank you very much for calling. Thanks so much. Here's a question that was just brought into the studio. Do you expect cases to make their way to the Supreme Court, which will address legal standing of migrant children? This has become a very significant issue.
Absolutely.
Are the kids illegal, undocumented refugees, etc.? Now, my understanding from the latest that the president has said is that we want to make sure that these children are taken care of and are housed properly, at least temporarily, until they are sent back to their homes. But what comments do you have on this?
There was a lawsuit just filed in Texas on behalf of these kids to get them legal counsel in these
deportation
hearings.
When I was in the administration for a year as the president's first senior counselor for access to justice, I tried very hard, but without success, to get the government to go along with the provision of legal counsel. I mean, right now under this 2008 law, these kids have a right to a hearing before an immigration judge, but there's almost no area of the law that is more arcane or complicated than immigration law. And what good is a right to a hearing? These kids have a right to a hearing. They have a right to saying, what good is that if you're not represented by somebody who's familiar with this?
And the government has a lawyer at these hearings.
Of course.
So there was a story on NPR earlier today. A 9-year-old little girl was at one of these hearings up against a government lawyer. And, of course, the judge is a lawyer. And what's she supposed to do?
Yeah.
No, it's a tragic situation. I mean, there's no easy solution, except I do think in this case they should not be regarded as immigrants or migrants. They're refugees. They're coming from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, coming from places where the U.S. government says it's too dangerous for Americans to visit. So sending these kids back to places where they're going to be much worse off than just not having a lawyer, their lives are at stake.
Yeah.
Maybe just too brutal.
Thank you very much for your comments on that. Alex, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I had a question about more the state of the courts. I've been reading a lot about how the public has been losing a lot of faith in the Supreme Court, or they've been having lower approval ratings, mainly because people are now under the impression that the court has become extremely politically polarized, and people are now, or the judges are moving towards either being voting liberally or voting conservatively. And I was wondering what you and your guests have to say about that, and kind of the state of the court and what they think the future will be, and how especially Roberts can bring the court back to being regarded as more of a neutral party that really is grounded in the Constitution.
Alex, thank you very much for your comment.
I guess my question would be, when was that? I mean, when did the people ever regard the court as neutral and not, during the Warren court, people had the same attitude on the other side. They thought it was a liberal agenda being enforced. So,
although, a lot of what I try to do in the book is help work through that whole issue of when we should regard the court as being too political, not political enough. The low approval ratings are sort of scary. They've never been quite as low since we started measuring them. Only 30% of the people trust the court. Now, I think in some ways the Chief Justice Roberts has tried to help by increasing the number of unanimous decisions, but sometimes the unanimous decisions just hide deep differences underneath. And I think when he was up for his confirmation hearings and he said that he wanted to have people recognize that he was just going to be an umpire calling the balls and shots, he was going to be neutral, that's true only up to a point. I mean, you certainly don't want a justice to bend over backwards so that the team he likes brings home the pennant. But every judge has a philosophy. Every judge has a point of view. And there's no escaping the fact that the people we put on the court and the backgrounds they have and the way they understand life as well as law is going to make a big difference to how they interpret the Constitution and apply it.
I suspect there's just a tiny handful of decisions that have brought about this attitude that the caller just mentioned. Bush v. Gore, mm-hmm. Citizens United, mm-hmm. and perhaps Heller. But first,
the gun case.
The gun control case.
I think it's more than just a handful. I mean, I certainly have strong feelings about Bush v. Gore. I argued and lost the first of the two Bush v. Gore cases in the Supreme Court among the cases that I've done. But I think, and Citizens United I have a lot to say about in the book, but I think the trouble is that some of the justices themselves are going on the stump and sounding a little bit more like politicians. And they're encouraging people to forget that the kinds of cases that get to the court are bound to be tough. They're bound to be difficult. They wouldn't get to the Supreme Court otherwise. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have nine justices if we expected them all to view these things the same way. We could just have one uber judge.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take some more calls. Thank you, Alex, for calling. And Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Great show and great series. My question is about the Hobby Lobby case. There's talk in the Senate of legislation to somehow override that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, since that decision has already been made, how can they frame the law in order to get around the decision?
Well, the problem there is it's not what you suggest, Dan. The decision was not about the Constitution. It was about an act of Congress. So theoretically, if Congress had the votes, it could get rid of Hobby Lobby in a nanosecond. But it's unfortunately impossible. I mean, even if the Senate, despite the filibuster rule, which still applies to ordinary legislation, were to pass something, we know that Boehner's House of Representatives would not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a non-starter. But not because the court has spoken. This is not a decision about the meaning of the Constitution. It's a non-starter because our politics is broken.
Well, assuming the votes were there, so you're saying it's an interpretation of the law? And so that
it's an interpretation of an act of Congress called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and the court was very clear that it was not saying that the First Amendment or anything in the Constitution entitled Hobby Lobby or the other companies to take this position. They were entitled to do it only because Congress gave them the right to do it, and what Congress gave, it could take away.
We're going to move on. Dan, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. We have a few minutes left. 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. My guests are Lawrence Tribe, constitutional law professor at Harvard Law School, also author of the new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution, and Myron Moskowitz, appellate litigator, appellate consultant, professor of law emeritus, Golden Gate University School of Law. And Judy, welcome to the program.
Okay, thank you. I'd like more about why Lawrence Tribe reacted as strongly as he did when the topic of religion and the part that it plays in the Supreme Court rulings was considered such a taboo. I think it is a taboo. I was just talking to a friend about that today, saying nobody will talk about the part that religion is playing in the rulings of this court. And I would like more about that.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason I reacted that way is that I've studied the court and argued there 35 times, studied it and taught about it for 45 years. I know the justices, several of them are my students. I just don't believe that it's their religion. I believe it's their political philosophy and their legal philosophy that's pushing them in one direction or another. And I think it is shouldn't be taboo. We should be completely free to talk about it. But I just feel very strongly that it would be wrong to think that Justice Ginsburg or Breyer or Kagan dissented in Town of Greece because they're Jewish.
No, I don't think so. That's not what I was saying.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think you're missing something, Larry. if you don't recognize that every judge's life experiences forms part of
Myron,
don't interrupt.
Let Myron finish.
Part of your life experience forms the way you believe as a judge. Now, if your life experience is you're part of a majority religion, and you customarily...
Larry, wait a minute. You'll talk after Myron.
That's one attitude to have that the majority in the town of Greece brought with them. The three Jewish justices, now I don't know them personally, but if they had an experience like you said you had, I had, being in the minority and feeling this subtle coercion in school, in various places, I'm just suggesting that may have played a part. It's not because they're Jewish. They could have been Muslim. They could have been Buddhist. They could have been Hindu. But if you're in a small minority in America, which is mainly a Christian country, you're going to feel these pressures and you're going to be more sensitive to it when you write your opinion than if you're in the majority.
Well, all I can say is that I've known a great many Christian and Catholic justices, including Brennan, who had much more sensitivity to what it's like to be discriminated against for any of a number of reasons, including religion, than lots of people who are members of minority religions. And I just want to make sure that people don't start stereotyping that way. It's bad enough to be putting justices in sort of little boxes about, you know, they're Republican or Democrat. Once we start categorizing them religiously as well, I think we are not going to make a lot of progress. Of course, the experiences that you had and I had being Jewish create some sensitivity, but there are a lot of ways of becoming sensitized.
We have one more caller. Patricia, you have it. You're the last caller.
Could you share your impressions of Clarence Thomas? He doesn't seem to say a word.
Okay, great. That was last question. Go ahead, Larry.
What he says is that he was brought up to believe that when people are talking, you should listen. I know the guy. He has a lot to say. I'm disappointed that he doesn't ask questions from the bench. It's kind of a weird phenomenon, but you can be sure that he talks a lot in conference at the court. And he does know the cases back and forth. So,
but Larry, he's an originalist.
Yeah.
Brief, take a half a minute and tell us what that means.
Well, you know, people claim that they are the more extreme version, which Justice Alito makes fun of. He says, what I think the originalists want to know is, did James Madison like video games? What did he think of them? But there's a much more modest version that doesn't try to read the minds of the framers. It just says we should give the Constitution the meaning that it had when it was adopted. Well, that's almost everybody believes some version of that. The point is, however, that its meaning was very general. You know, the word liberty didn't ever have a fixed meaning. It had a meaning that depends on context and history and circumstance.
Let me just add, Thomas, you know, he's been heavily criticized, but I think he really contributes a lot, maybe not an oral argument, but his opinions are very well written, very reasoned.
Right.
They take a position that most of the other justices don't, but it's I really enjoy reading them, even though I'm not always persuaded by them.
Right. I mean, like in the case involving the sale of violent video games to minors without parental consent, all eight of the other justices, including Scalia, didn't agree with Thomas that children should only be seen and not heard and that they have no free speech rights. The court disagreed on whether those rights included the right to engage in simulated mayhem and murder on video games without their parents' consent. That's one where, you know, I think there was a lot to be said for Justice Breyer's dissent when he said that it's really crazy for the government to have power to censor sex, but not power to protect kids from being conditioned into violence through these sort of perpetual immersion in simulated murder.
We are out of time. I want to thank you both very much for joining us on Your Legal Rights. Professor Lawrence Tribe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Constitutional law professor at Harvard Law School, new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And thank you, Myron Moskovitz, for coming to this program probably at least 15 times. Appellate litigator, appellate consultant, professor of law emeritus, Golden Gate University School of Law.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Your Legal Rights Protection people who have helped me on the program, and production staff members, program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Trust in the State section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, we're going to be talking about estate planning for your golden years. My guest will be David Hellman, specialist in estate planning and taxation, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Thanks for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.